Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, September the 1st, Labor Day, all across Canada. You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM, coming to you from the top of Burnaby Mountain in Burnaby, British Columbia. My name is Magnus Thiewald. I'm your host for this hour of programming. And joining me later in the show will be Peter R.H. We have some good stuff lined up for you. We have a report from Danny Nesvadarani, our community reporter here at CJSF, about Burnaby Council endorsing a call for an arms embargo on Israel, the first community in Canada to make that call on the federal government. We have a report about a powwow in Calgary recently that was a great community success, bringing together newcomers and Indigenous folks and everyone from the community for a great celebration. A really nice, uplifting story there. Because it's the holiday, we're going to bring you a revisit one of the documentaries we created as part of a program we called Making Time for Radio a number of years ago. Radio documentary on the journey of a Guatemalan family from war-torn Guatemala to safety in Canada. Hope you enjoy that. We also, of course, have a Gardening with Embark that Pablo Vimas joins us and talks about what you need to know in the garden. And we are at the end of the summer, and it's time to take stock of what we got there and what's happening and do a little cleaning up as well. So Pablo will take us through that just after the half hour. And towards the end of the program, Peter R.H. is going to talk about Brazil and the IMF and all of that ensued. It's a good program today. We also have Bird Note and so many other things, but we're going to start off with Danny's report on Burnaby Council taking a stand on the situation in Gaza.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvadarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On August 26th, Burnaby City Council unanimously voted to pass a motion which calls on Burnaby Mayor Mike Hurley to advocate for the federal government of Canada to establish a full two-way arms embargo with Israel and transform the Gaza Temporary Resident Visa Program to support the safe reunification of Gazan Canadian families. Additionally, the motion called for Burnaby to become a signatory of the Apartheid Free Cities Pledge. Burnaby is now the first city in Canada to call for a full and immediate arms embargo on Israel. Before the motion was passed, City Councillor and author of the motion, Allison Gu, stressed the importance of this decision by quoting a Palestinian resident of Burnaby, Mohat Sarhan.
We are all watching in horror and pain as Israel continues to carry out war crimes amounting to genocide in Gaza, Palestine. The International Court of Justice, the ICJ, has issued multiple rulings calling for immediate action by all countries to prevent the genocide of Palestinians. The ICJ has advised the world not to assist in maintaining Israel's illegal presence in the occupied Palestinian territory. Unfortunately, a July 2025 report shows that Canada is still arming Israel. Canada has sent almost 500,000 bullets to Israel since October 2023. Meanwhile, Canada's immigration response has been inadequate and racist, especially when compared to Canada's rightful actions for Ukrainian refugees fleeing Russia's invasion. Only a few dozen Gazans have arrived in Canada since 2023, compared to nearly 300,000 Ukrainian arrivals. Amnesty International calls this a heartbreaking failure and saturated with anti-Palestinian racism.
Next to speak was City Councillor Daniel Tatro.
Hearing from many residents in Burnaby, and I'd like to also share
a little bit from one resident, Dina, who, like myself, is Jewish and a descendant of Holocaust survivors. And these are their words. I've been horrified to witness the atrocities my grandparents experienced repeat themselves over the past 22 months. I believe that never again applies to everyone, and that never again is now. For peace to take place, justice has to be served first. And the first step towards justice is to call the injustices out, and this is why we are here. Your decision today will pave the path to a city that is not complicit or participating in fueling the apartheid and genocide in Palestine. Your commitment will empower local Palestinians to feel safe in speaking out against the genocide and about the anti-Palestinian erasure and racism that many endure in schools, community programs, workplaces, and in their advocacy efforts.
The council chambers were filled with Burnaby residents awaiting the council's decision. And when the motion passed, the room erupted in cheers. Afterwards, CJSF spoke with some of those in attendance for their initial reactions to the city's pledge, including Burnaby resident Mohat Sarhan, who had been quoted earlier.
It's a small step in the right direction. It's nice to see council recognize the suffering of its own residents, such as myself. I'm Palestinian. Like I said, small step, but I feel like this might ignite a spark if other cities do the same. Eventually, the federal government has to listen to us and give us what we want. So, yeah.
We also spoke with Harsha Walia, a local activist and Burnaby member of a campaign calling for a Canadian arms embargo with Israel.
Yeah, so City Council unanimously voted in favor of the motion for Palestine, which as Burnaby residents we're really hopeful about and grateful for, and hope that every other level of government will follow suit and doing what Burnaby did, which was to call for a full and immediate arms embargo on Israel, call for the immediate transformation of the Gaza reunification program so that Gazan Canadian families who have family members trapped in Gaza can evacuate their families, and also for the city of Burnaby to become apartheid-free, which means to break all ties with the settler Israeli regime, break with apartheid. Burnaby's going to have no city contracts with Israel, and this is incredibly important because, you know, we are watching every day the horrors of genocide in Gaza, and we know that every level of a government absolutely must refuse this complicity. This motion is absolute proof that every level of government, including cities, including provinces, if they wanted to, could absolutely take a stand, break the consensus, break the imperialist consensus, and absolutely say that there should be no arming of Israel, there should be sanctions on Israel, and that Israel should absolutely be isolated and sanctioned, and there should be charges on Israel for this genocide.
Great job, Burnaby!
This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
This is Bird Note. In the early 1800s, the passenger pigeon was one of the most abundant bird species in North America, possibly the world. A single flock, more than a billion strong and miles long, could darken the sky for hours. But by 1910, the last surviving representative of the species was a bird called Martha. She was named after First Lady Martha Washington and spent much of her life at the Cincinnati Zoo as part of a captive breeding program. In the wild, passenger pigeons amassed gigantic breeding colonies in deciduous forests, preferably packed with their favorite beech nuts and acorns. Naturalists from that period wrote that a single tree might host 90 nests or more. Research suggests that the number of passenger pigeons fluctuated dramatically with the availability of food in forests. But with added pressure from habitat destruction and commercial hunting, including the harvest of breeding birds and their chicks, their populations couldn't recover. After outliving several unsuccessful suitors, Martha became a beloved celebrity at the zoo in her final years, until September 1st, 1914, when Martha passed away and the passenger pigeon was officially extinct. Though today is a somber anniversary, there's no better time than now to step up for conservation. Learn more about what you can do to protect birds at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Children's laughter, joyous comments, whoops, yells, and clapping. These and other joyful sounds were heard across the Tinaland. This is a welcome to our land. This is an introduction across nations and across cultures. This is the Healing Together Powwow. Hosted at the One Spot Crossing Campground, this family and newcomer-oriented powwow was bigger and better than ever this year, its fifth year running. Newcomers from across the globe representing 14 countries were welcomed onto Satina land to learn and heal together. People of all ages, nations, and backgrounds came together. Some were born right here, and others had only been on Canadian soil for less than 2 weeks. Daniel Mistaken Chief shares the goal of the Healing Together Powwow and how they are using this opportunity to help others heal with them.
Well, the goal here is that we're trying to help people heal because people have lived through traumas. Everyone has done, has lived through those, and it's our way of bringing people together just to have a nice time to visit. We bring in the newcomers so that they get to see First Nations firsthand. And they get to visit with us without having government officials or anybody else around. It's just person to person. And it's been really successful, as you've seen today. Like, we had 2 busloads of newcomers come today. And would you believe that there's a group of that people that came had just come from a refugee camp. And their first experience out from the safe home in Calgary was to come to our Healing Together powwow.
Additionally, for the first time at this powwow, the One Spots hosted an elders circle with elders and knowledge keepers from both Cree and Blackfoot nations coming together to share and aid one another. Flora Northwest, a Cree elder from Muscochese, Alberta, shares fond memories of her grandfather, how her culture was reintroduced to her, and how First Nations culture is now reviving.
When I was a young girl, I first saw our traditional dancing powwow, and it was the men that were dancing, and the beauty of listening to the drum, because I was raised in a home with the drum. My grandfather used to wake up every morning, make his tea in the morning, and then he'd take his drum out and he'd do his morning meditation with the drum, his morning song. He did the same thing in the evenings, where he would do the same thing, take the drum out, but this time it would be outside, and he would do his drum song, evening song, and that's how I grew up till I was about 6 years old, and that's when they took me to the residential school. So they cut me off at an early age, and then I didn't see the powwows till probably in the 60s, and then from there, you know, they started the Indian days with powwows such as this. And the women became a part of the circle. And it was beautiful to come home to our identity. And as years went on, you know, the young people became a part of the circle. I know a lot of I've been at the school for many years. A lot of your students used to take fashions, and even the boys, because they were taught how to do beadwork. And there's a lot of young people coming home to their identity. And today, I don't get intimidated with our culture, because this is ours. You know, it belongs to us.
Alexander Skelplock from Sitsika Nation, who returned for his second year as arena director of the powwow, shares the benefits of powwow during hard times.
Sometimes we go through bad times in our lives, whether it be depression or we're feeling down our spirits. You know, this is a time to come to the powwows, because it's a social event where we want to come together and enjoy one another's company. It's also a time to see old friends that we haven't seen for a long time. It's also a time to make new friends.
Reporting for LJI and CJWE in Satina, I am William Blico.
Do you know what your local wetland has done for you lately? Wetlands function like nature's kidneys, mitigating the impacts of floods and droughts, protecting our communities, and supporting food production. Despite representing 6% of the Earth's surface, wetlands store 33% of the planet's carbon. If you value life, thank a wetland. Learn about wetlands at work with Ducks Unlimited Canada at ducks.ca/wetlands.
Guatemala, a Central American country that borders Mexico, was most recently in the news for finding a former president guilty of genocide.
By unanimous decision, the court declares that the accused José Efraín Ríos Montt is responsible as the author of the crime of genocide.
Even though the trial was restarted on a technicality, this is all part of the country's effort to overcome the effects of a devastating civil war that lasted 30 years. The conflict, which started in the 50s, was fought between leftist guerrillas and the army. The UN estimates that 25,000 people died, but other organizations say it could be as high as 40,000.
During a 36-year civil war, 45,000 students, political activists, and peasants were disappeared, and 200,000 Mayan Indians were killed in the countryside.
Naty Garcia is the daughter of a Guatemalan couple who fled the war. They arrived in Vancouver when she was 3 years old. Now 30, Naty is 5'5", dark-skinned, she's got brown eyes and a quick smile. Despite arriving at a very young age, Naty usually wears traditional Mayan clothing and identifies with the culture her family left behind. Naty's parents are Mayan, a a group of indigenous people who live in Central America and parts of Mexico. They were heavily targeted by the military during the war. Like thousands of other Guatemalan refugees, Nati's family was forced to flee when their hometown became a battleground. According to Nati, when they arrived in Vancouver in the late 1980s, they didn't have many things to call their own.
We lived in a one or two bedroom place, our first home, and it was about five of us. So we all shared this one mattress. So there was a lot of tension sometimes, and people wanted their own space, but didn't get that. But we'd all have to sleep on one mattress. And I remember that. And everything was very old in the household. Everything was secondhand. It was gifted. It was from donations. And I remember our clothes never really fit us well enough.
Vancouver is nothing like the place her parents grew up in. Her family is from a region called Ixcan in the Guatemalan jungle. Even though her family didn't have many material possessions, Fabiana Morales, Nati's mom, has fond memories of the village she grew up in. Given its climate and location, it was a perfect place to grow crops. So despite being a poor area, Fabiana says they were never hungry. Violence spilled into Ixcan when Fabiana was 18 years old. The leftist guerrilla had been operating in the region for a while, but the real problem started when the discovery of natural resources got the army interested in occupying those lands. The army was brutal in its mission to control Ixcan. They used the scorched earth strategy, destroying everything in their path and killing everyone who they considered a threat to their control over the region. Fabiana, who only speaks Spanish and Mayan mom, told us about when the army made its way into her village.
The next day we saw it with our own eyes. We saw smoke. They were already burning the houses. They were burning everything in their way. So we left.
Fabiana and her family fled to the mountains. The lush vegetation provided many hiding spots, but the army was tirelessly tracking them down.
The army realized that some people were still alive. They started shooting everything that moved. We heard the shots being fired, and that was the day we decided we couldn't hide there anymore.
Ya no podríamos estar ahí en ese lugar.
Ill-equipped for the journey through the treacherous Guatemalan jungle, some decided to stay behind.
My father said, "You go. I will stay here to die because I don't have little ones." So he stayed. He said, "I'm going to find a little corner here in the mountain." My parents lived on that mountain for 12 years.
Fabiana and her family spent 8 years as refugees in Mexico. When they arrived in Canada, other Guatemalan refugees became the only connection to the land they had left behind. Before we continue, we want to warn listeners that the next section contains a testimony that some people could find disturbing.
When I was 8 and 9 years old, we went to a friend's place in Surrey. We were really good friends with them at that time. My parents were good friends with them at that time. It was a celebration, a party. So we went to this person's place to be in that space again. And we had ended up staying that night at that friend's place because my parents weren't sober enough to go back home. And all the kids that were there with her had ended up being put in a room where we'd sleep all together. And we'd slept there a few times in the past. But this one night in particular, when I was really young, there was this one person that came in to that room when I was asleep. And I remember waking up feeling that it was a dream and it was really dark. And this young person had kind of woken me up by pressing his arms onto my body. And I remember opening my eyes and seeing this person looking at me, And I remember having this feeling of fear, this feeling of pain, this feeling of what is happening. And then this person had ended up doing these sexual kind of actions that I wasn't familiar with at that age. And I actually ended up closing my eyes really tightly and hoping that it would go away. And then ended up waking up my eyes, opening my eyes again. And it was daylight and all the kids were awake. Somebody was making breakfast downstairs in the kitchen. And I remember thinking to myself that maybe it was a bad dream. Maybe it was something that I always felt that it was a bad dream.
Even though the experience had left her deeply disturbed, Nati decided not to tell anyone what had happened to her.
I didn't tell anybody because I felt I didn't understand it. I wasn't sure. I would never had that conversation with my parents about respecting your body, about if you ever feel anyone that does any harm to you in any way, or if you feel scared in any way in a moment, to let us know. I hadn't had those conversations with my parents or had built that trust enough with my parents.
That wasn't the only topic they didn't discuss, though. Nati's parents had never told their children about the hardships they faced during their exile. Nati's questions were always met with evasives or silence. When Fabiana arrived in Canada, the country felt like a totally foreign place to her. She didn't know anyone, so she stayed home a lot. Unable to grow her own food, Fabiana felt she couldn't connect to this new land. And without any professional help, she and her husband were having issues coping with their past.
My husband used to have a lot of problems. He was maybe 20 or 25 years old when the war started, and that kind of affected him. He used to feel a little bit of rage, and that made him start drinking. Sometimes at the house, he would be drunk, and all that rage he had, he would take it out on us. He would take it out on the family. Sometimes he would hurt the family, so the children started being afraid of him.
My parents' relationship was, I feel, was full of a lot of tensions. I remember listening and witnessing to some of the arguments that they would have and not understanding where it came from, but only feeling the emotions that came from it.
All the tension, sadness, and silence drew Nati away from home. Feeling disconnected to her own family, she befriended other teenagers from troubled homes. At age 12, she became sexually active, and then she started drinking and doing drugs. Her parents didn't know what she was up to. She barely spoke to them.
My relationship with my parents during my childhood was, there was a lot of anger. I did not communicate with them at all about anything. I hated them. Like, I just, especially my dad, I hated my dad. I felt that he had brought all of this pain to me. I felt it was because of his alcoholism. It was because of the violence that he brought into the household that it drove me to where I was as a teenager. And my mom, I hated my mom because I felt that she wasn't there for me.
Nati still hadn't come to terms with what had happened to her as a child. She frequently had a disturbing dream about a shadow sexually forcing itself into her. But she hadn't considered the possibility that the dreams were based on reality. Everything changed one day when she ran into a familiar figure while picking blueberries with her mom.
I remember in a far distance seeing this figure of a man talking to my mom, and I guess talking to the other family members there. And I remember just this feeling of fear just entering my body. I just became paralyzed. That paralyzation, similar to what had happened during that incident, I felt that again. And I was triggered by this figure and did not know what it was. And it wasn't until later, and I had like run into like the blueberry bushes, and I had just hid there. I just stayed there. I didn't want to come out. And not until later on in the evening when that person had left, and we had gone back home, I started to ponder on that question as to why I had felt that way.